Chapter 2. The Encounter. The Delta region of Central California is known for its fertile soil and acres of flat farmland. It has an elaborate system of irrigation, taking advantage of miles of rivers, sloughs, and canals. The abundant water of the Delta is also enjoyed by boaters and other water sports enthusiasts. Crops of tomatoes and corn are rotated throughout the year, with corn being the most abundant produce. By late September, many of the cornfields have been harvested, leaving rows of dead yellow stalks. This time of year arguably has the best weather because the winds are light and the temperatures are comfortably cooler than the summertime triple-digit days. In a terrible melancholy mood, I drive slowly home from Bill Garber's farm. The trip to my high school reunion last week was a fiasco. Not only did I almost have a coronary on the flight, but none of the friends I hoped to see were there. The day after the reunion, I canceled my return flight out of anxiety. It was a long drive home, but at least I had plenty of time to think about things. Mushrooming phobias are bad enough, and now my anxieties are compounded by this job. Feeling downcast, my arms weigh heavy as I cling to the steering wheel for support. As bad as I feel, I'm afraid Bill feels worse. Bill owned Rusty for over 14 years. Rusty was a good-tempered, intelligent dog with friendly eyes and a happy-go-lucky grin. Through all the years, he was Bill's best friend and companion. He was special to me, too, because as a puppy, Rusty was one of the first patients at my clinic. Owning an animal hospital has been a challenging experience. I have two nurses to assist me and a receptionist to manage the schedule. Running the business side can be a chore, but the most difficult aspect of being a veterinarian is diagnosing the animals. We have many reliable techniques, but it would help if the animals could talk. I have always loved animals. While growing up near Colorado Springs, my family raised and trained guide dogs. My father taught aviation history at the Air Force Academy, and in his free time he enjoyed restoring classic cars. Helping him work on those old cars taught me a lot about mechanical stuff, and the time we spent together was priceless. I showed a natural aptitude for machinery, and my dad hoped I would become an airline mechanic or engineer, but my real interest was in animals. After graduating from high school, I enrolled at the University of California at Davis Veterinary Program, located just west of Sacramento. I met Jennifer at the university, and after graduation we married and settled in a small farming town on the Delta. We found it to be a good place to have a family, and we liked the fact that we were only an hour's drive from the San Francisco Bay Area. Normally, I don't perform out-of-office euthanasia on Saturdays, but Bill had explained to me how Rusty had whimpered and cried all night. That poor old dog could hardly walk, and he suffered in constant pain. No matter how many times I have to put someone's cherished pet down, it's never easy. I try to be strong and supportive for the owner, but the experience is always emotionally draining. Cruising along the narrow country road, my thoughts begin to wander. Normally I'm a cheerful and optimistic person, but lately my world has grown dim with the feeling of walls closing in on me. Although I have little to complain about, I'm in a rut. My options seem to dwindle as I get older. I'm not sorry I chose the career I did, and I'm certainly not disappointed in my family, but my life is about half over now, and I feel like I'm missing out on something. As far as I know, I'll only get one shot at living. Isn't it natural to want to assign more meaning to life? Surely others my age begin to look back and wish they had done more, mattered more, or lived more. We think we know so much. We think we have all the answers. Science and technology are great, but come up short. In my mind, the biggest questions are still unanswered. Where did we come from? Where are we going? Is there a reason? What is life? I don't go to church and prefer not to argue religion. I just don't care to have one particular faith confine my beliefs and dictate how to interpret things. I'm not knocking church or religion, because I believe they contain many valuable lessons. Can my fear of flying be helped through religion? Maybe a therapist can help my fears. I prefer to solve my problems on my own because I believe if you look hard enough, the answers will reveal themselves. It may not be obvious at first, but you just have to keep your eyes open. I've always enjoyed music because it soothes my spirit and soul. Now, about 7 miles from home, I pop in a CD. Jimmy Buffett sings Cheeseburger in Paradise on my truck stereo. It does little for my mood, but starts my stomach growling for lunch. As my truck rattles and shakes over some railroad tracks, I'm reminded of that last plane ride. I figure if I were in flight, an airline pilot would probably consider this a little area of bumpiness or light turbulence. My tire could easily have a blowout and send me crashing into a ditch or oncoming traffic. Why am I such a nervous wreck on a plane, but hardly seem concerned about crashing my truck? Is it because the news media sensationalizes airplane crashes? Countless car accidents receive much less attention than plane crashes. Why is that? Now with my window open to the outside air, I try hard to appreciate the day. The sun is warm, but without the scorching heat we received last month. Up ahead, I notice a couple of birds flying in a curious way. My eyes aren't as sharp as they once were, so I squint to see more clearly. The distant birds circle and pursue one another in a crazy and aggressive fashion. I've seen this before when one bird will chase another from a nest, but something's different about these particular birds. Nose to tail, they hound each other unlike any birds I have observed. They are the same size and shape, but one is blue and the other green. Next, they fly wing to wing, performing playful swooping dives and graceful coordinated turns. High in the sky, they dance and frolic for a time. Then, spiraling and corkscrewing, they glide downward to vanish in the distance behind a cornfield, never once flapping their wings. Do birds fly and soar for fun? Do they value and appreciate their freedom? I thought they only flew for food and to flee their predators. What magically strange birds these must be. I have heard inspiration is all around us, but our motivation must come from within. Witnessing this extraordinary display stimulates my fascination. If I was a bird, I could be free of nagging worries and unbridled from gravity. To soar without boundaries and unfettered from fear, I too could find sanctuary from life's woes. I feel a burden lift from my body, and no longer do I slouch in my seat. My mood mysteriously improves as I picture my life as a bird. I would never fear flying. A bird isn't concerned with turbulence, air pockets, or engines dying. They never worry about who's in control or if a wing will shed. Never does a bird feel claustrophobia or dread. Birds are fortunate to be free from the phobias I find so trying. Relinquishing my worries, I think ahead to my afternoon plans with my family. Far from the majority of houses, my road leads me past fields of tomatoes, freshly plowed soil, and more corn. After a while, off to the right, I notice a flash of color in a sea of golden stalks. An unusual-looking craft down one of the dirt roads catches my attention. Slowing for a better look, I watch as a tall figure walks to the edge of the road and kneels down to gather round objects off the ground. Whatever he's doing is surely none of my business. Glancing at my watch, I gauge how much time it will take me to get home. I promised my family I'd be back in time to take them to an afternoon movie. We always look forward to spending time together, especially now that Shannon is so busy with school and work and Jennifer is always on the go. Although they were disappointed when I told them about the house call, they understood. I should just go home, I thought, as I continued to watch the odd figure stooping to pick up another round object. With the intention of driving straight down the road, my foot strangely eases off the accelerator and onto the brakes. My hands turn the wheel to the right, and I veer off the pavement down the dirt road toward the strange vehicle. Why the heck did I do that, and why do I feel my life has also taken a new turn? As I approach the unusual machine, I recognize it as a small aircraft. Bright blue fabric covers the wings and tail. The body is bare, consisting of metal tubing and wire cables. Its engine is on top of the wing with the propeller behind. Low to the ground, the cockpit sits out in the open and has two low-mounted side-by-side seats. A control stick is located between the seats, and two sets of rudder pedals are over the nose wheel. Here before me is one of those birds I'd seen earlier. Its pilot is loading round green objects into one of the seats. I stop the truck and prepare to get out when I'm momentarily frozen by the sight of a second little plane. It emerges from behind the cornfield in a steeply banked turn. This plane is similar to the first, but this one is green. Rolling wings level, it lines up on the road, bearing down upon us. Through my windshield, I see the blue plane and its pilot, and just beyond is the green plane growing rapidly in size as it approaches faster and faster. The sound of a tightly wound engine growls as the plane powers just a few feet above the dirt road, kicking up swirling dust devils in its wake. A nauseating bolt of dread forms in my stomach as I'm certain to witness an awful mishap. I try to scream to the blue plane's pilot, but I'm paralyzed by fear. He casually piles the round objects into a seat, oblivious to the danger. The green plane thrusts toward the parked plane, and with no room to spare, it pulls up steeply just before impact. Leaning forward, I see its wings flex from the terrific strain as the plane zooms skyward. Just as it loses its upward momentum, the plane cascades over into a hammerhead turn. The motor becomes hushed as the plane smoothly glides around to settle gingerly on the road, coasting to a rest a short distance away. Relieved, I get out of my truck as the pilot of the green plane unfastens his seatbelt and takes off his headset. He's medium height with a happy round face and wavy brown hair. He's wearing sunglasses, jeans, and a t-shirt, which reads, United Federation of Planets. Getting out of his seat, he dashes over to the blue plane, and the two pilots begin an unusual banter, all the while ignoring my presence. Enthusiastic, the green plane's pilot calls out, "Hey Dan, I've got to reload. Wow, this stash of munitions you found is probably the best yet." The pilot of the blue plane is tall and lanky, with salt and pepper colored hair and a thick mustache. He has crow's feet around his eyes, a leathered face, and strong calloused hands. Calmly pointing to the objects in his seat, he smiles and says, "Yeah, Rich, check out these bunker busters. I bet these babies can penetrate reinforced armor plating." "I scored a number of direct hits with my laser-guided smart bombs on that rebel freighter. Then I followed up with a high-altitude carpet bombing of their shipping channel," reports Rich, proudly raising his hand up in an animated gesture. I inch cautiously closer. They must have seen me, but they act as if I'm invisible. What in the world are they talking about? Are they playing some sort of imaginary game? "Good show," Dan says. "You've got to take out those targets of opportunity when they present themselves. I'm reloading with some cluster bombs. Why don't you get set and we'll go secure the perimeter? Then we'll head back to Dreamland and see if Amelia wants to go for a ride." Eyes beaming, Rich replies, "Good idea. I think she'd really enjoy that." With each bizarre statement, my curiosity grows. I suppose they're just up to some harmless fun, but I can't figure out exactly what they're doing. They act strange, but seem friendly enough. Throughout life, I have found some of my best friends were the ones I had the most to learn from. Although many of my old friends are a bit unusual, I would probably find them dull if they behaved normally. Right away, I feel a sort of kindred spirit with these two. They fit the mold of the friends I've had, and I feel a connection. The two men finally pause a moment and glance in my direction. One offers a smile and a wave. My movie plans forgotten for a moment, I'm drawn to these fascinating little planes and their unusual operators. I casually approach, not sure how to initiate the conversation. "Hello there," I call out. "Excuse me, I was just driving by and stopped because I was curious about your planes. I was wondering if you need some kind of license to fly these planes." The taller one, who appears to be about 50, smartly replies, "Yeah, a pilot's license?" Okay, I guess that was a dumb question, but I feel like I need to establish a dialogue with these two guys to find out more. I try another question. "Your planes sure look fun. What are you guys up to out here?" The pilot of the green plane, Rich, who looks about 35 years old, is now gathering small green melons from the side of the dirt road and loading them into the right seat of his plane. He pauses to reply, "We're flying reconnaissance sorties, performing intelligence gathering, and striking enemy positions to reestablish total air superiority." Dan chuckles good-naturedly. "Yeah, and God knows Rich could really use a lot more intelligence gathering. What he means is that we're just buzzing around dropping these wild watermelons on an old sunken boat out on the river for fun. We don't mean any harm because we just do it for the challenge." On the verge of another dumb question, I ask, "Aren't these planes dangerous to fly?" As those words left my mouth, I hope they wouldn't take it the wrong way. I was afraid the question I just posed might imply they were either stupid or insane for flying their little planes. Rich's face became serious, and he answers, "Maybe, but I think my life is at greater risk if I don't fly them." That was indeed a strange answer. How could it be more dangerous to stay on the ground? I try a few more questions. What are they? How high and fast can they go? What's the horsepower? Where do you keep them? I could see the two men become bored with my questions, but Dan politely answers anyway. "They're two-seat ultralights, but the FAA has recently categorized them as sport planes, because technically ultralights are only supposed to have a single seat. These planes take off at about 20 miles per hour, and in cruise they go about 50. They can get as high as 20,000 feet, but the real fun is down low. We run a two-cycle engine, which puts out 65 horsepower, and we keep them in a hangar not too far from here at a private airstrip. Their planes look simple in design, but sophisticated enough to be high-performance, versatile machines. With open cockpits and exposed to nature's elements, it must be an intimate way to experience flight, low and slow, taking in the scenery. I can think of several other questions, but I don't want to keep them any longer. As I start back to my truck, I offer a wave and shout, "Hey, thanks for the info. I'll let you get back to your bombing missions. See you around." With their munitions of wild watermelons, they mount up and promptly prepare for flight. Fascinated, I stand in front of my truck to watch. Seatbelts fastened and headsets on, they yell, "Clear!" With a yank on the starter handle, their engines purr to life, letting off a wisp of blue smoke. With a burst of power and a cloud of dust, they lift off in a surprisingly short distance. Leveling at 10 feet high, the two small craft skim slowly over the tops of the cornfields in tight formation. Appearing to be joined at the wings, they slowly shrink into the distance. Isn't it every child's dream to fly like a bird? Open-mouthed and in awe, I am left alone to imagine their adventures and certain amusement. For a moment, I dare to wonder what it would be like to go for a ride, but quickly dismiss the thought. I can't even stand to fly in a big jetliner, let alone an ultralight. The notion of being up over the fields and looking down at the earth below with nothing but thin air between sends a tingling sensation from my stomach up my spine and into the back of my neck. My legs go wobbly and my head spins as I stagger backward to find welcome support against the hood of my trusted truck, planted firmly and safely on solid ground.